cliffcentral.com.
Carrie Adams is one of the most interesting people in South Africa because she knows a huge amount about one particular thing, although she'll tell you that she only knows a little, and I suppose we'll find out how much of that is true in a moment or two. But I'm talking about her and talking to her this morning because I met her properly. I mean, met her years ago, but we sat and spoke for 15, 20 minutes at a lunch the other day, and she had me so engrossed with the stories of how she got involved in wine, where champagne comes from, what kinds of wines there are, that as someone who's a bit of a Philistine when it comes to this stuff, I found myself being more and more intrigued by what I was hearing. And I'm delighted that she managed to find time in a very busy schedule, because you're always running around and having glamorous lunches and things, to be able to talk about wine with little old me. How are you, Carrie?
I'm fine, Gareth. Thanks for having me.
No, it's a pleasure.
And I'm not always running around having glamorous lunches.
I've
my life
you.
Is far from glamorous.
Delies.
But I am really, really pleased to know that at 50-something, I could captivate the heart and mind of a gorgeous 30-something-year-old. How,
you
old? How old are you, Gareth?
40.
30, 40?
40.
Okay.
Read them and weep.
Yep.
But yeah, it was. It was fascinating because we sat down, and you know, a lot of these things are very, you kind of, you assume you're going to be sitting next to someone boring, and there are a lot of boring people at some of these events.
The wine industry has produced possibly more boring people than maybe the banking or the insurance fraternity. I'm not sure.
Really?
I think so, yeah.
In
days of yore, and even now actually, you can get yourself stuck next to a crashing bore who with any sort of prompting could bore themselves to death. I don't know why. It's because I think they've tried to make wine so complicated so as to preclude everybody else from this little secret society. It's almost like a gothic type thing where you need to knock three times to come in and find out what's
like a cork,
you know.
Skull and Bones,
it is.
You know, club that only a few people can belong to.
That's it.
Well, it's nonsense because you said to me that wine is the most democratic thing of all.
It is.
And it was there from time immemorial. It wasn't ever something that only rich people drank. In fact, in Rome, there was probably more wine than fresh water.
There was, and so there should be. And the only thing that we're all angry about is that very learned man ascended back into heaven without leaving the recipe behind as to how we could turn that water into wine.
I mean, imagine Cape Town have got the converse problem, obviously.
If we could turn wine into water.
If Jesus had just left the recipe.
I know, and we could just have done the reverse.
So
yeah.
I was interested, first of all, we started talking and I asked you about how you got involved. And you told me a really interesting story about how you were working for some lord in England who got you in to do sort of secretarial stuff.
Yes.
And then eventually took you down into his cellar because you were preparing a dinner and you needed to get some wine for his guests. And
yeah.
He said, oh, well, go down to the cellar. And you found this treasure trove of incredible and expensive and exclusive and sexy wines. That, and it just got you started on a trajectory
as I said to you, my very limited knowledge of wine when I got there. I was young. I was 20-something. And I was doing a secretarial-type job for this frightfully noble Englishman. And I managed to busk and wing my way through most. But when the boardroom lunch came and I was tossed the keys of the cellar and told to please pair the wine with the, you know, with the fillet of partridge or whatever it was, I knew that I was a little bit out of my depth, and I thought, this is definitely not autumn harvest crackling, and it's not tussies, and it's not any of that. I need to own up. And I did. I owned up, and I said, look, I just can't do this wine thing. Please help me. And he did. He helped me from there, and it was a passion and a common love that we shared for a long time, that I worked with him and for him. And I ended up studying my British wine exams and things as a direct result of him. And that's where my passion came from. He just recognized a passion and a curiosity from me that I think fascinated him. He was an old stuffed shirt who probably thought, little South African girl, you know.
Well, he thought he could teach you things, and maybe he did. But he also got you to study the stuff
he did.
From a theoretical point of view. So you did the chemistry.
I did all the chemistry and all the stuff that needed to go with it, for which he paid as well, ultimately. He paid for all of that, so I'm forever grateful for that.
Oh, what a cool dude.
No, seriously cool. Britain is just sort of infinitely civilized, you know. It remains so, and it will always be. We discussed that at length as well. And then armed with all of that wonderful knowledge, I came back home to South Africa a few years later, and I continued to do my thing in the wine industry. And it is, it's a wonderful world that spans everything. So it doesn't matter whether you are a paraplegic, or if you've got a hand growing out the back of your neck, or if you're black or white or gay or straight, or you can all enjoy wine. And I love it because it's completely non-discriminatory in its form and fashion.
So the history of wine, because this is where we started our conversation. We'll get into the different kinds and all the rest, because this really was the introduction that I always needed. Mm. The same as when you went to him and owned up that you didn't know anything. So I've never tried to I've never tried to be pretentious about these things, because I don't know a lot. I know which wines I like, but I can't tell you why. It's the taste, really, or the smell.
That's all
or,
it needs to be, really.
Right. Mm. So, I mean, you also made me feel at ease about that, because, you know, a lot of people, if you say something like that, they look at you and go, oh, really? As if you...
No, well, it's crazy. I mean, have you ever in your whole life come upon a profession where you study long and hard for a good sort of 5-6 years, and then, armed with all of that knowledge and your olfactory system upon which you rely heavily, you are then tasked with sniffing and swilling and spitting and documenting 40 glasses of wine. You're not allowed to know what they are. It's called blind tasting.
Yeah.
And then you have to write down who you think made them, where they came from, what grape they're made of, what region, what vintage, I mean, it's bizarre.
It's a very strange thing to do, right?
It's
not a real job.
It's not a real job. So do you go to the steakhouse and say to the bloke, I'd like you to put 6 rump steaks in front of me, please, and I would like you to just pinpoint which part of the animal it comes from, old the animal was.
And I'll cut a piece of each one, taste it, and then spit it out.
Yes, and be tentative. Look into the air. Try and think about it and say, I think it's Vereeniging area. Do you know what I mean?
It's ridiculous.
It's bizarre. How can we have a thing like this?
But there are people who make a living doing this, and some of them are considered very, very important and terrifically smart people. And some of them may be, for all I know. I
mean,
I know you could smell a glass of wine and instantly tell me what kind of grape it was.
We try, but that's really just training. And listen, it is an art. I think some people are born with it, like some people can draw and some people can play the piano and some people can dance. I do think that some people are gifted with a more finely tuned olfactory system, and I think
so. You
that
can
helps.
Smell. I mean, do horrible smells affect you far worse than the rest of us?
You need
they give
to
you
speak,
headaches.
You need to speak to my family. My nose is my downfall. I can smell
something rotten.
Something rotten. I suppose that you're starting to worry now, sitting opposite me, wondering what I can smell. It's a bit like a psychic.
But you do have it's a superpower.
It's a superpower. I only put my cloak on at night, though.
the hard part about that is the bad smells, but
the smells are bad.
The good part is that you walk around a garden, and the smell of the different flowers must be overpowering for you.
You know where the peonies are. You know where that honeysuckle is because you can smell. If they break a bottle of whiskey downstairs in the basement, a million miles away from my desk at Norman Goodfellow's, I say, "Who's broken a bottle of whiskey?" You can smell it. It's just the craziest. You know, like a dog has got these amazing smelling capabilities. Some people have that too. And so that helps if you want to be in the wine industry. But it is a load of codswallop, really, really, really.
But I've heard that it's not, you can tell if someone is a complete bullshitter because the first thing they do is they taste instead of first smelling.
Smelling is much more reliable than tasting for me.
So now when they bring a bottle at a restaurant for me to test, then I know to smell.
You just sniff it.
Don't need to have a taste.
Mm. Do you sniff your hamburger too?
What are you doing? You're just checking them. It would be so rude, right? But you're actually just checking to make sure it's not vinegar.
Yeah. You're just checking. The only thing really to check is that there should be nothing floating about in the glass. So any floaties are a non-starter.
Yeah.
And it should be nice and bright and clear. And it should smell like wine and not like any chemical of any description. So as soon as a wine smells teensy bit chemical, or there's a mustiness that comes with it if it's been bottled under cheap cork and it's what they call corked. I mean, it's daft because there's a cork in it, so yeah. It's a corked bottle of wine. But that's a very definite fault that can happen. So you just don't want it to smell like anything other than fruit. It should just smell like fruit.
Okay. All right,
you would know if you were going to drink a bottle of frot guava juice.
You don't. You don't have to be. I mean, this is we've got a natural inbuilt ability to smell things that are off because 100%. Our body knows that's poison.
Don't eat it.
In fact, that's probably the only reason we have a sense of smell.
It is.
Is so that we can avoid poisonous things.
And
things
people.
That are clearly off. And people, can you smell a poisonous person?
Yes, definitely.
All right. So when we were sitting talking, you started explaining to me the red grape varieties.
Mm.
Now, I know this might be a little arcane for some people. For some of us, this might be the higher grade lesson that we need later on.
Yep.
But you actually explained it quite simply to me, and I'll tell you how much I can remember. You said to me, Cabernet Sauvignon is the boss.
It's the boss.
Of all red
it's
wines.
It's the business.
And you're gonna tell Shiraz, you said, had a little bit of a, you said it's ancient, it was made
ancient.
In Persia,
one of the first,
right?
Yeah, Persia, one of the first red grape varieties ever found.
And it's
ever
got
made.
A little bit of a spiciness to it,
no,
is what you said.
Peppery. You've
okay.
got, you've got
right.
a photographic memory.
Well, no, you when
okay.
people make a lot of sense
you
like
see.
You, then you started down Merlot and all the, so am I in the right ballpark for you to take
Absolutely
over?
Absolutely are. So Cab is the nobility of the red grape varieties. And some people will fight with me, but Cabernet is king, really, at the
okay.
end of the day. And it is a big, strong, muscular. And you know what wine really is if you think of it as the grape is, it's like a hanger, it's a skeleton. And then on that hanger, you drape things over it to make it, if you're an interior, a fashion, say you're a fashion designer.
Okay.
So you've got your model and that's your grape. And Cabernet gives you structure and you get some more sort of backbone from tannin, from the stems and the leaves and the pips and this and that. But the basic drapery comes from the DNA of that specific grape. So Cab is just, it has a presence whether you invite it in or not. It is just the king of red grapes. It's strong. My grapes have also got genders. Did I mention
no.
that to you?
Cabernet really?
Is a boy. Cabernet
okay.
is definitely a boy. It's strong. It's masterful. It's not a boy. It's a man. It's like Sean Connery. Cabernet,
oh,
Cabernet
wow.
is Sean
okay.
Connery.
So we're giving them personalities.
We're
now.
Giving them, I'd never even thought of the personality, but he is a real man. So Cab is big and he's strong and he's, but he smells gorgeous and he ages well. And
can we grow this anywhere?
No. You can't grow it just anywhere. There are certain regions that grow Cab better than others. And the home of Cabernet really is a part of Bordeaux in France. There are regions, I mean, we grow beautiful Cabernet in Stellenbosch, for example. It likes to be in a little bit cooler of climate than you know, like Shiraz can grow in rocky desert Mediterranean type climates and just sends its roots all the way down into the gravel and what have you. Cab's a little bit more pedantic about where it's grown. It likes to be a little bit cooler. It likes a long, slow ripening period. We can go on ad nauseum, but Cab is this gorgeous, it's perfumey, but it's expensive perfume. It's not
right.
It's not Fabergé.
Okay.
Oops, we shouldn't have said that. We'll be in trouble from Fabergé. Let's cut that one out, Gareth.
All right, how about the Shiraz? You described the Cab as Sean Connery. So who is
Shiraz? You know, Shiraz is a gorgeous
Please
grape.
Don't say Harvey Weinstein.
No. No, we're not going there at this stage of the game. So now, Shiraz is a delicious grape.
Okay.
But it has a few intrinsic sort of missing links. It's ancient. It's Persian. You get Shiraz carpets as well if you go and visit Victor Leachy or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It was a place in Persia, and I think that after that the grape was named. But Shiraz is a gorgeous grape, and at the moment in France, where they grow Shiraz in the northern and southern part of the Rhone in France, which is sort of going down towards the Med, It loves Mediterranean climate. It likes gravelly soils. It's got a root system that will go right the way down there. But Shiraz is sort of like the AIDS baby of the wine industry. If there is a ho-ho or a something about, it catches everything going. So it's very susceptible to disease and stuff. You know, it's a bit susceptible to disease.
Okay.
So it needs quite a lot of puffing and blowing. You need to make sure that it's comfortable and it's doing its stuff. And when it is, it produces grapes that make this gorgeous purpley red kind of brambly wine. And when I say brambly, people don't often know what I'm talking about, but brambles have a certain smell. It's like a nettly sort of a smell. But it's got a English violets. You probably don't know about those either because you come from South Africa, but it smells of English violets. It's a gentle, delicate perfume, sweet, ripe fruit on the sort of mid palates. And then when you swallow it, you get this gorgeous twist, like a dusting of white pepper. There's just this like white pepper on the back palate of Shiraz. That's how definite, you know you're drinking Shiraz when you get that white pepper. It's so, what's the word that I'm looking for? It's so typical.
Characteristic.
Characteristic of Shiraz. So Shiraz has always been deemed in France, well, not always, it's not the Burgundy, it's not Romney-Conti, and it's not Chateau Petrus. It's always been a little bit of a poor relation in France. But now, recently, there are a couple of producers who are producing such delicious Shirazes, and they are such good value for money compared to the thousands of rands that you are paying for, which is another discussion we'll have one day. You and I could talk forever. People are paying 60, 70, 80,000 rand a bottle for a bottle of Chateau Petrus, or 150,000 for a Romani Conti.
Are those the most expensive wines of all?
Yes, they are. They are very the Romani Contis. Well, the DRCs are expensive, and there's a whole lot of things called first growth. We could do wine 101, wine 102. We could do a whole thing on it.
Are they exquisite?
Yeah.
Or are they just very expensive because someone knows how to put a label on a bottle?
No, they're things that have earned layers and layers and layers of pedigree over many hundreds of years. And they have remained exclusive. The DRC is a tiny little parcel of land in Burgundy in France, which produces only just so much wine, only just so many bottles of wine. And they will never extend it to anybody else. It is exclusive. It's exclusivity in its most vile form. But because of it, it is the most desirable, exquisite wine. They perfected the art of winemaking. It's Pinot Noir. It's made out of Pinot Noir or Chardonnay. And there's only a very, very tiny allocation for everybody in the world who wants a bottle. So you just can't get the stuff. So it's got a pedigree that it's developed over time, you know. So it's an earned price.
Now, you mentioned Burgundy. Are there certain parts of France that produce very, very exotic, and I'm not just going to talk about France, we'll get to the other places just now, very exotic stuff, because it sounds to me like there are certain kinds of red grape that are considered to be important and the rest are almost like a curiosity.
Run-of-the-mill. Absolutely. So,
basically, what are the ones?
In Bordeaux, you get Cabernet and Merlot. Merlot is an interesting grape.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you about it in a minute. In Burgundy, you get Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. In the Rhone, you get Grenache, you get Shiraz, you get all those gorgeous Roussanne. In the Loire, you get Chenin Blanc. In Sancerre, you get Sauvignon Blanc. So they have specific regions in France that it's law. You're only allowed to plant specific grapes in those specific areas because they've done all the tests and they know that that's what produces the best wine. I wait for a day when we do that here. It's starting to happen here, but there's no law. People are just finding that Shiraz grows beautifully in the Swartland, which is why we've got all this fun sort of Swartland revolution happening.
And South African wines are considered internationally very competitive.
They are, because they're so cheap, really, by comparison. They're so cheap. And if you consider that our wine industry is over 300 years old. because it was 1652 when old Jan put his first foot on Table Mountain and said...
And Simon...
And Simon van der Stel and what have you. So it's well over 300 years, so he can't really be considered too much New World.
No, I mean, America is much, much newer.
Much, as is Australia. So our wines really should have gathered more impetus and more international recognition than what they have by now. But we did have that little spot of bother in the middle there where nobody wanted colonialism and apartheid.
Kind of fucked up a lot.
It did sort of screw it all up for us, but we're trying. Yeah, we're trying. Clawing back.
All right. Now, you also mentioned Chardonnays and Sauvignon Blanc. Those are white wines.
White wines. So,
is there a thing I don't know about people who drink white wine and people who drink red?
You know what? It's just an identity. It's a genetic thing. So, you and I have specific genes in us that make us have light hair and green or blue eyes and white skin and the odd mole or freckle and a pointy nose and long eyelashes.
Thanks. You just described me perfectly. Okay. All right.
I was going to say something, but I'm not. It's on air and I get into trouble. So Angela Feng Shui has got yellower skin. She's only got jet black hair. She's got much smaller eyes than we have. It's a genetic thing. Mm. It's a DNA thing. So that's what it is with grapes. So Sauvignon Blanc has got a specific DNA that gives it specific characteristics that nobody else is going to have. So you'll get other Sauvignon Blancs that, like you and I, both have the same sort of genetics that make us the same color and the same sort of look and feel. But
we're all still kind of different.
We all look different. Yeah. We've all got two eyes and nose and a mouth, but we all look a bit different. So it's exactly the same in the wine industry. So Sauvignon Blanc, I told you, I'm not mad about Sauvignon Blanc. It's fresh, it's clean, it has a certain appeal. She's a girl. And I said, if she went to the matric dance, she wouldn't be asked to dance. She would spend the whole night standing at the wall waiting for someone to ask her because she's boring.
Oh, my God. That's so depressing.
It's a bit sad. But she's boring. She's one-dimensional.
Is Chardonnay better?
She'll laugh at the wrong jokes. Yeah. Chardonnay is gorgeous. Chardonnay is sexy. Chardonnay can be full and voluptuous and very enticing. Sauvignon Blanc is lean and mean, and I think she spends her life in the gym, and she wants to be picked at like a 21 belling so that she's got this tight, sinewy sort of linearity. And she's going to be strapped into a really, really skinny, flimsy dress and think she looks beautiful, but Chardonnay is just going to be gorgeous and all over voluptuous.
Yeah, I got
voluptuousness.
You. Voluptuousness. So I like a Chardonnay.
We like Chardonnay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Chardonnay is a bit of a bitch in the cellar, though.
Why?
Difficult, can be difficult to make. It's a Burgundian grape. The Burgundians are full of shit.
They're too close to Belgium.
Ooh, I hadn't thought about that. Maybe they are.
No.
It's that Flemish thing.
That's it.
Yeah, okay.
And also they weren't sure where they belonged for years. They were partly German, then they were partly French, they were partly Belgian. They don't know. The Duke of Burgundy wasn't even necessarily French.
He wasn't necessarily French. We've got the same in Alsace, where we make beautiful... Beautiful things, but beautiful
Alsace,
wines.
Or as the Germans call it, Germany West.
Yes, and sometimes they're run by the Germans and sometimes they're run by the French. But in the middle of all of it, they've produced some of the most exquisite Rieslings. Gorgeous wines in the world, they really do.
Is a Riesling always sweet?
Mm-mm. No, you get a dry Riesling. You get a very sweet one. You get a medium, off-dry one. Riesling is a gorgeous
Are the
grape.
Italians any good at wine?
Oh, they're just the best. I'm looking for an Italian blesser.
Really?
Mm.
Is that where you want to go?
That's where I want to be. So if any Italian blesser is out there
Is that
listening
where it started
us,
properly?
Well, you know, the Romans are responsible for a lot of nonsense that's gone on planet Earth. Because they were there so much longer than, you know, before than
it's
anybody else.
Like a 2,000-year Reich they
so
had going
the
there.
So the Greeks and the Romans, honestly, I think we should blame them for apartheid. I think we could have blamed them for a lot of stuff, to be honest. And we can blame them for wine. They all started making, the Greeks made wine first, I think. Who came first, the Greek or the Roman Empire?
Greek
Empire. They came first, and the Greeks still make wine to this day. God help me and bless me for some, bless them. They make a thing called retsina out of pine nut kernels, which they started recently making better wines. But retsina,
that sounds like a poison.
Retsina is not to be taken lightly.
What is it? I mean, is it hardcore?
It's wine that smells like, a little bit like benzene.
Oh, holy hell.
Yeah. And it's got a little benzene. Bitterness to it. And it's
Can you use it to clean things?
I would. Brass. Brass door handles.
Brass?
No, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. I'm going to have the Greek mafia after me after this goes.
Okay, so what do the Italians make?
Italians make the most gorgeous stuff. So there's a Marchese di Antinori who everybody wants to marry.
Yes.
Including me.
Tell me.
But he doesn't even look my way. I'm the girl at the matric dance with the Marchese di Antinori.
Oh.
They make things in Tuscany. They've got grapes that are called Sangiovese and Nebbiolo. And lots of other ones as well. But those are sort of the main grape varieties. And they've got some super Tuscans, which are very expensive wines. Ornellaia, you'll pay a lot of money for a bottle of Ornellaia, bottle of Sassicaia.
Do you ever bring any of those in here?
Yep, we've got them available in South Africa. And they are, honestly, again, they are wines that have been made with such purpose and such love and such care.
For hundreds of years.
For hundreds of years. And they are, you know, wine should be bright. And I don't know how else to explain it, but when you put a sip in your mouth, it should be light on your tongue. It should feel like it's polished. It should feel like it's the shiniest string of pearls in the jewelry shop window. You know, that glossiness. Wine should have that glossiness on it. And it should feel light and easy to coat your mouth. It shouldn't be sticky or hard or heavy or edgy in any way. It needs to be round and glossy in your mouth. And those Tuscan wines are that. They are black cherries, ripe black cherries with tinges of hinty little cedary hints from the wood. Like a little cedar smoke on a really fresh, ripe black cherry.
That is amazing.
No, they go.
The way you describe it, it's like you're in love with this.
I'm in love with wine. I love wine. I don't drink a huge amount of it, to be honest. But when I do drink it, I want it to be like that.
Special. Someone once said to me, the same should be true for coffee. I don't drink a lot of coffee. If I did.
I like other things to make my heart race.
Yeah. But if you did drink coffee, you'd drink really good coffee. Because what's the point, if you're doing something regularly, of having shitty substandard stuff? Huh?
It's the same with anything in life.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
we all make that mistake. We always go, well, that's more reasonable. The price is lower. Yeah. I think I'll go with that. And then we end up upgrading anyway, and we end up paying for both.
I know.
Silly.
You upgrade when you wake up with that headache the next morning. But
is that how you can tell if it's a shit wine?
Sometimes. You normally get a headache because you've drunk too much, to be honest.
Mm.
It's not really too much to do with the quality of the wine.
Are you? Do you have rules about daytime and nighttime wine?
I'm quite compartmentalized. My life is all in colors. My days are color-coded, my years are my months, my wines are all in genders. So you know me, you know what you're dealing with. It's a complete freak of nature. So yes, wines, I'm not sure that I would do a big super Tuscan at 9 o'clock in the morning. It's when I might sidle up to that boring Sauvignon Blanc.
Okay.
Because she's bright and fresh and clean, and you can almost brush your teeth with Sauvignon Blanc. And then, of course, there's many, many other varietals that we haven't even started. We haven't even ventured.
All right, let's leave wine for a minute because we could, as you say, we could talk all year about wine. So what about champagne?
Oh, we love champagne.
So how did champagne come to be?
Champagne came to be because they were shipping wine from France to England across that English Channel. That's how port happened as well.
Oh, yeah?
And things just start doing a second fermentation in the bottle. You know, if there's any little bits of yeasts that are left in a wine bottle, if the temperature's correct and the one yeast cell checks the other one out and thinks, they just start to undergo a little second fermentation in the bottle, which causes the release of more carbon dioxide within the bottle, and it makes it bubble. So these things were arriving on the other side of the channel and people were opening this sort of crown cork that was on it. It was going, And they quite liked it. And then the French obviously understood and realized that there was a bit of a market for these daft Englishmen across the water. And they put a little bit of what they call dosage, which is it's like a liqueur. It's like a wine liqueur, which tops it up and riches it out, fattens it out and sweetens it up just a teensy bit. And it really did become a very,
So the English really invented champagne or fostered
the French did, but the English were the market for it. And to this day, England is a massive market for champagne. And now, you know, they started planting their own grapes. God help them. I don't know what's going to happen. They're hugely expensive. I can't imagine how they're managing to ripen those grapes. I mean, everything is like a mushroom growing in a dark cupboard in England. Because you only have like 5 days of sunlight.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So how are we going to ripen these grapes? We don't know. But champagne only requires, it doesn't need to get very, very ripe because we want it to be tight and we want it to quiver and we want it to have lots of natural acidity. And that's what champagne has to be. It's got to be like sherbet. Remember when we were little, we used to get those bottles of sherbet powder.
Yes.
And it made your tongue go, and it's like bubbled. It was effervescent. That's sherbet. That's champagne. That's what it tastes like.
Champagne, is it true that the smaller the little bubbles, the better a champagne it is?
Yeah.
Why is that?
It's just that it's become more refined. It's been left longer on what they call its lees. You know, they've kept it in that bottle where they sort of turn it around in those racks every single day for 5 to 6 to 7 to 8 years.
Wow.
Everything just becomes much more refined with time.
Can you keep champagne?
Yes.
How long?
You can. And I have got certain customers who love aged champagne. And the older it gets, if it's been made beautifully, the older it gets, it becomes nutty and creamy and rich and
like a mousse.
Like a big mousse. And it's got beautiful, the mousse, which is the bubbles that we're talking about, it becomes golden. It the whole thing looks like an old aged beer, really, when you pour it into a glass. But it's got this lovely skinny little beads of tiny fine bubbles, and it's got this nuttiness and creaminess on it. So champagne is lovely. I wouldn't keep it for much longer than about 30 or 40 years. Because it really does start to lose its zip, you know. And there's no like quick fix. There's no Viagra for it when you pop that cork finally. So it's not gonna go zing in your mouth.
Right.
Anymore after 40 years. So I would drink it within 40 years.
Now, obviously, we could talk about wine and champagne, but there are a whole lot of other things that I wanted to discuss.
There's gin and there's whiskey. And
yes. Okay.
Yes.
So there's a massive gin thing going on at the moment. Mm. Everybody's into these gins.
Yeah.
They're no longer just juniper berries. Now people are making gin out of everything. I met someone the other day who's making protea gin.
Yes, I saw that as well.
Yeah. What's that all about?
I'm a bit of a traditionalist, you know. I do sort of swing west every now and again, but I like things to be traditional largely when you're coming to food.
And shame,
juice.
There's no other use for juniper berries. So
there's
we have
no
to...
other real use. It is a bit of a
we have to support
loss
the juniper.
Leader. Yeah. The other thing is that London Dry Gin has to be, or gin has to really have the presence of juniper in it.
Mm.
I don't want my gin to taste like marijuana or rose hips or whatever. And let's be honest, once we've put the tonic in.
It doesn't matter anyway.
We've sort of killed the taste of the gin anyway. So the trick for me is that you need to spend a lot of money on a really well-crafted tonic that is not going to drown out your taste of your gin. And then choose a gin that's been beautifully handcrafted. There are a couple. There's a mountain. I mean, we've got about 200 different gin labels on the shelves at Norman Goodfellow's at the moment.
God.
So, and a lot of them are local. But there are some extraordinarily well-crafted gins. A Frenchman who's making a gin in South Africa in Cape Town called, what's it called? You know, Geometrics. It is absolutely gorgeous. It is on the same level, I think, as The Botanist, which is a Scottish gin, which has for many, many years been one of my favorites. So there's different qualities of gin, and the quality of gin is gauged by the amount of botanicals, the quality of the botanicals that are put into it, and the amount of times it's been distilled. So there's lots of stuff going up and down chimneys and flues, and you're catching lots of vapors.
But what makes a good tonic?
What makes a good tonic is as little sugar as possible, so that you are not going to have your gin crowded out by all that ghastly gin, sugar. And as little fizz as possible, because you don't want it to be too, too fizzy, because as soon as there's too much carbon dioxide in there, you can't taste anything. Mm. Carbon dioxide almost numbs your taste buds. So you can't taste too much. You can't taste much other than sugar in an icy cold drink. If you make Coke or tonic or ginger ale or something very, very cold, icy cold, and put it in your mouth, it's not often that you even know what you've got in your mouth, because it's just the bubbles actually freeze your taste buds. So you don't have a good tasting experience when you've got too much CO2 in your mouth.
All right. What do you make of people who drink vodka? They say that you can't smell vodka. How do you even know if you've got a good vodka? How do you know? I mean, isn't
it depends how fearsome the Russian is who's making you drink it.
Because apparently Russians will make this stuff from petrol.
Oh my God, they
from
make
all
it
kinds
from
of things.
Anything. Vodka should be made from potatoes if we're really thinking in terms of vodka, but it's a starchy sort of a thing. But it's, again, it's the distillation process that determines the viscosity of the vodka at the end of the day. So if you distill something once, you run it through a blooming distill, a still, and you've got rocket fuel that you're actually distilling, and that's what a lot of those vodkas are. You can taste it. It tastes and smells chemical. It's horrible. Mm. But if you hand making, and you do buy good quality spirit, and you distill it 3 or 4 or 5 times, every time you distill it, they don't do it that much. Because you lose too much of the liquid with every single distillation. So that's why it becomes more and more expensive. But it does end up changing the mouthfeel of the vodka. So it'll be a bit glycolic and a bit oily and a bit smooth with every single distillation.
So I'll drink wine, which usually accompany a meal. Won't drink it on its own for no good reason. Because I drink tequila.
No, Gareth.
Is that okay?
You've gone down in my
Is that all right? You seem disappointed.
I'm very disappointed.
Are you really?
The owner, no.
Because I like tequila. I know a lot about tequila too. I care about it very much. It's an upper.
It is.
A lot of other alcohols is a downer.
Now, gin's a big downer.
Yeah.
Brandy can be a big downer.
Yeah.
Tequila's a big upper because it makes you think that you can take over the world.
Yes.
It makes you behave in the most lunatic.
Yes.
Fashion.
So far, you're winning me over.
Yeah,
you're not having the opposite effect.
It also goes to the back of your knees before it goes to your head. So you generally fall down, thank God, before you make too much of an idiot out of yourself. You generally do fall down. It smells ghastly. It smells like cactus plants, and I don't like the way cactus. I like the way roses smell, not cactus plants. I also have to say that I've only been really, really embarrassingly, alarmingly drunk, so much so that I didn't know who I was that day or the next or possibly for a week after, and it was tequila that did that to me.
Yes.
And so, you know, when you've eaten a rotten oyster.
You'll never have oysters again.
Yeah. So that's
So you're prejudiced against it.
So it's totally, totally personal.
Ah.
It's got nothing to do with the quality or the esteem or the privilege or pedigree of tequila. I believe there are beautiful ones.
There are some superb tequilas. And I'm telling you, the next thing after gin is going to be tequila.
I think it's going to be rum.
No.
Love rum.
Rum is for pirates.
I was a pirate in my last life. I think I was a pirate.
Rum is very hardcore. My God, it burns on the way down.
No, but that's because you're drinking pirate's rum. Instead of the king's rum. It's rum is
I've
one
got
of,
Jamaican in me, you know that.
Have you?
Yeah, my grandmother was
With
born in Jamaica.
Mm. Blimey, can you speak habaneros or whatever?
No. Habaneros.
Do you eat jalapenos?
That's Mexican.
That's Mexico.
No,
what's
I'm
in
Jamaican.
It's Jamaican coconuts.
Well, yeah, and rum.
And
Jamaican rum.
Rum.
That's where they make
it's coconuts. Do you climb those? Yeah.
They make it out of sugar cane,
they
right?
They make it sugar cane. We make cane. Mainstay is basically very cheap white. White rum.
No, really, the only people that drink that are the people that
so
you.
Now,
That
Listen
you see under
me,
the bridges,
Gareth.
Right?
Here are the, that's because it's so cheap.
Okay.
So here are the choices. You can drink tequila that turns you into a hooligan.
Yes.
2 seconds flat. Embarrasses you deeply in front of your friends and family.
Yeah, that's why they like me.
Hits you in the knees. You crash. You crash and burn. You could break your nose. You wake up the next day not knowing who you are, where you are.
Sounds like you've had very nasty experiences of this.
Or you could do a gorgeous aged dark rum.
Okay.
Which is to be shared in front of fireplaces.
Isn't that the,
naked
isn't
on bearskin rugs?
But,
I mean,
okay,
what
but isn't that the province of cognac, rather than rum?
Cognac, you can do that too.
Cognac is
rum,
the sexy kind of
cognac's
civilized
sexy,
thing.
But rum
is for people who are seafaring and violent. Yes,
it's bearskin rugs and naked bodies, fires, talks. No, that's what
okay.
rum is. Soon as we start getting some really decent rums into South Africa, and we are starting to get.
All right,
some.
Then you teach me.
But, I'm going to teach you.
Tell me about why we've got a country that's obsessed with Bronnewijn. What's that all about?
Because we make such good brandy here.
Really?
We make the best brandy, and all the Frenchmen who come here, and I interview them on radio, and I do whatever, they are so proud of cognac, and cognac should be proud of. Hmm. I mean, they should be proud of it. It's a gorgeous little bubble of beauty in the middle of France, and they distill this gorgeous libation. And some of them, they do. You know that in cognac, some of the cognac makers don't ever get to see their product sold. Because
it takes so long
that
they could be dead by the time their first bottle's produced.
It's such a labor of love that they devote a lifetime.
That's like those people who plant a plantation of trees.
Never see it cut down.
Wow. How long does a good cognac take to make?
Well, you can make beautiful cognacs in 15, 20, 30, 40 years. You can. But there are some extraordinary ones that are older than
that. So when I go into a store and I see those crystal bottles of Louis XIII that cost, what, 20, 30? Oh, sorry, 100. Yeah. I apologize. I think I just lost my appetite for cognac.
150,000 rand.
For a bottle.
Yeah, and there's some cognacs that even more. We've got a whiskey. We've got a single malt in our Christmas catalogue this year for 650,000 rand for a 50-year-old whiskey. But what I was about to tell you is that whilst cognac is gorgeous, South Africans do make the most delicious brandy.
All right.
So you don't have to spend 150,000 rand to buy a pot still brandy from Backsburg, Sydney Back.
Okay.
Potstill is gorgeous. Takara. GZ Ferreira's Takara. Got the most delicious 5-year-old Potstill brandy. And I'll teach you to drink that too. I'm telling you, you won't want a tequila after that.
Look, it's not a taste thing. It's not the taste.
What is it? It's the way it makes you behave.
Yeah, it's the effect. It's all those things.
So you
that
want
saying.
To be King Willy. Yeah, you well, want to yeah. be. You want to be the.
yeah. Pretty yeah. much. I'll grow up eventually, but it'll be too late for all of us to change anything.
You and my son.
All right. What about whiskeys? Let's just go into that briefly, because I think a lot of people in South Africa like whiskey. I think a lot of people want to like whiskey, and it's not a complicated thing to understand. You get the blends and you get the single malts.
That's it.
Right? And the single malts are the ones that are grown, not grown, rather that are distilled at a particular, peculiar distillery, usually on the Spey River if it's in Scotland. Whiskey with an E is an Irish whiskey.
That's it.
And the Japanese whiskeys are a whole different thing, which we'll get into now. Bourbon is what the Americans make. They make that out of?
Rye. Some of them are made out of rye.
But then they send their barrels to Scotland.
No. They do send some of their barrels to Scotland. And Scotland sends some of their barrels across to America. There's a lot of barrel swapping going on because barrels and aging are really the only two final deciding factors.
What are the people called who make the barrels?
Coopers.
Coopers, that's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's not like R.K. Cooper and Son, you know?
No.
It's
And it's quite a thing
Coopers.
To
it's
do
It's another
this.
Thing that South Africans are very good at. The colored community in the Cape are very, very good coopers. There are a lot of people from France who come and steal colored people and take them back to France.
Sounds like slavery.
It sort of is.
Yeah.
But when they do it in Europe, it's okay.
Mm. Well, that's where they started some slavery, right?
Yeah.
All right, so whiskey, what do we need to know there?
Whiskey is a hugely, single malt in particular, is a hugely popular and very fast-growing category in South Africa. It stood still for a long time because we were always historically a white spirits drinking nation, or brandy and white spirits. So it was vodka and brandy and cane, really, that was drunk spirits-wise in South Africa. But, you know, I just think that we've sort of, how long are we now? 25 years into a democracy of sorts, and there's a whole lot of people. We are starting to see an emerging middle class. And with that emerging middle class, we managed to muster enough buying power to spend, because they're expensive. I mean, a single malt whiskey is upwards of 600 rand a bottle. So I think that there's been, we've always sort of longed and lived for and wished for a strong middle class, which we've now got. And so we are starting to see upward trends in things like single malt, cognac, up top end vodkas, that sort of stuff.
So we're a drinking nation, without a doubt.
We're a drinking nation, not wine.
No, but we like to drink.
We like to drink.
And we drink a lot of beer.
We drink beer and we drink brandy.
Now, are you at all perturbed by all of this craft beer nonsense that's going on?
It's just another category, really, which is a pain in the butts. It's because you've just got another 2,000 SKUs added to your computer program. And you've got to manage another 2,000 products that have got an expiry date on them. And it's all hectic. I watch with interest, and maybe one day we must see if we can have a get somebody from SA Breweries into this boxing ring here and see what their take, what their real take is on the craft industry. They've been incredibly supportive of it for quite a long time. But it seems to me almost like a brewery's tactic, you know, where...
Yeah, I met a guy on Friday night. I was out with some friends and I was at the bar ordering drinks. And this guy said, oh, you've got to try my beer. My beer, he said. He had a glass with a sort of symbol logo thing on it, and he had his beer at this bar.
Yeah.
He wanted me to try it. I don't drink beer. So I said to him, I'm sorry.
I like some of the dark ales, like the amber ales. In England you get things called barley wine. It's a dark, dark, dark.
Did you take a huge knock in the liquor industry when Princess Margaret died?
Yes, and then the Queen Mother. That was an even bigger one.
Do you think there's anything better? I mean, some of my favorite people in history, whether it was Churchill.
He was a great drunk. He used to drink.
Absolutely.
They made a champagne after him.
Yes. And
Paul Roger.
And a happy man.
He was a happy man.
You know?
Man. And a clever man.
Very clever. And one of my favorite authors, Christopher Hitchens, who died just a short while ago, said that there's absolutely no greater thrill than to get very, very drunk. Even for someone, it's nice, right?
It's just the way you feel afterwards. And you're still young, but wait, you'll see what starts happening. What did Christopher Hitchens die of? Throat cancer eventually?
Yeah, he eventually.
I read that book. It was the most alarming book that he wrote. I think his wife finished it.
Mortality.
Mortality. Mm. One of the best books I've read in a long time. I think that alcohol is, and I actually, joking apart, I feel quite strongly about alcohol because it shouldn't be legal.
What?
It shouldn't be legal.
Are you arguing against your position?
Yeah, because it's all just pious shit, quite frankly, because I know that I'm closer to those pearly gates and they're going to say to me, what did you do for a lifetime? And I'm going to say I peddled booze. I encouraged alcoholism.
You're a booze peddler.
I even did it on account so that people, if they couldn't have it, could have it. Do you know what I mean? It's been bad. So
when you
it's
put it that
all
way.
Part of my 2,000 Hail Marys that I've got to say before I die. Anyway, joking apart, it is a pleasure, but it's incredibly easily available. It's the biggest gateway drug, Gareth.
Okay,
but
all right.
Gateway drug
before
in the
you
world,
completely ruin your whole PR exercise here, which is that alcohol's. Let me just remind you that for some people, their lives are hard.
Mm.
They don't get a lot of joy.
Mm-mm.
There's
well,
a lot
people.
Of responsibility. People's jobs don't fulfill them. People's families annoy them.
Life's not everybody wants. Up what it's,
no,
you know, it's not
so,
what it's cracked up
so
to be.
So for some people, that weekend where they can sit and have a beer or a whiskey or a vodka or a glass of wine or whatever it might be that they need.
Mm.
That's their moment.
It is their moment, but it's a moment that needs to be moderated, because there is no worse thing than an alcoholic. It's deeply pathetic. Alcoholism is deeply, deeply sad and very pathetic. So you don't ever want to see somebody going down that alcoholic road, you know?
Yeah, it's never,
and we
it's never
see
happy.
Them come in and out of the shop. And purple. It's always, you know, purple noses and bloodshot cheeks and eyes and, you know, huge fat tummies and bulbous noses. And it does ghastly things to you. So it changes your physical appearance because, I don't know, I think the alcohol all ends up in your nose. I don't know how it is that alcoholics have all got such big green and purple noses. It just is.
That's so revolting.
It's horrible. So alcoholism needs to be taken seriously. And it does not make you feel good about yourself. It makes you feel good. It's that elusive, it's that soap in the bath. And every time you catch it, it just slips out of your hands, you know. You think that you're feeling better, but you're not. So you don't need to become an alcoholic. You need to have one or two drinks, and that's about it. Throw that tequila away, Gareth.
All right. Fine. I'm not going to gin, though.
We got all kinds
I'm not
of
doing
other
gin.
Lessons
I'm not
that
doing
we're going
to
do.
I'm not doing vodka. Don't have much time for them.
Rum? You could maybe
well,
rum?
You're keeping me
I'm
on gonna this rum
do the
idea.
Rum. I'm going to do the rum.
In the meantime, you keep telling us what's good and bad.
Mm.
All right? And make sure that – and you're not going to lose your love for this anytime soon.
I'm not going to lose my love for it anytime soon. In fact, if I play my cards right, I can carry on talking nonsense about booze until the day I die with people like you who like
it
to
would
hear
be,
stories.
I do like your stories, and we only touched the tip of the iceberg.
Maybe we'll do a boozy story time for Friday nights.
Boozy story time.
Not
I like
Friday
that.
Nights. Boozy story time. Instead of reading your child, now it's time for
boozy story nights with Gary Adams.
So instead of doing Humpty Dumpty and that sort of stuff.
Boozy story time. All right, I love it. Let's kick that off immediately. I love it, Carrie. Thank you.
Thank you, my
it's awesome
sweet
to spend
boy.
A bit of time with you, and thank
and
you for talking
you.
To me about this stuff.
Thank you.
Do you ever, you don't ever get bored telling people these things?
No, I've got a million stories to tell.
Okay, good.
I'm going to write a book good. For you.
Why don't you?
I want to.
So?
I haven't got time at the moment.
Just put in a couple of things
to.
About the president's...
I know, and get it banned.
Yes, and then you'll make millions in sales.
And then I'll have made enough money, and we can go away to Jamaica and drink rum and write more books.
And Italy.
And Italy.
Where you can teach me about these.
I can take an
what do you call them? High Tuscans. What?
Oh, super Tuscans.
Super
you were paying,
Tuscans.
Not paying attention, but we could also maybe see if the Marchese de Antinori would be interested in us.
Oh, hell yes.
Hmm?
I'm keen.
I'm dead
Let's go.
Keen. Yeah, okay. You're going to have to do the one
no
selling the body. You're going to, I don't know. I'm sure there must be a couple. But you're going to have to do the one selling the body and hope to goodness that. It's going to be attractive one way or another because
yeah, well,
I'm too old to be selling the body.
You got to go for the wine. You're doing this for the wine. It's not about, you know.
I know.
Probably blind, deaf, mute.
I know.
Old. There's a woman they wheel around Spain called the Duchess of Alba.
Yes.
In fact, I think she's still around. Ancient, ancient woman who's had so much plastic surgery.
I've seen her.
Yeah.
She looks like a puppet in Spitting Images or something.
That's the one. And she sometimes wears, you know, those Spanish headdresses that those infantas wear. Those horrible things like
she's probably been
a Giotto.
Drinking tequila.
Yeah, well, probably.
And she thinks she can take over Spain.
I'll marry her. She's got a way to go. All right. Well, listen, thank you.
Okay,
this has been fun.
Thank you. CliffCentral.com